Good morning. Hi, everyone, and welcome to First Things First. Jenna Wolf, Hall of Famer Chris Carter. This right here is Nick Wright. Good weekend, guys.
Absolutely.
Spent a lot of time in front of a television?
Of course.
Somebody's phone is on. Is it mine? Don't let it be mine. Don't let it be mine. It is not mine. That means we're starting off the week correctly. What a weekend it was in the NFL. Cowboys, Colts, Chargers, all moving on. But we're going to start this morning, CC, with two words. Those words are Nick Foles. The Eagles' backup quarterback looking to keep the Eagles rolling against the Bears. Philly down 5 with less than 2 minutes to go. Foles, Alshon Jeffrey takes it down to the 2. 3 plays later. On 4th down, Foles to Golden Tate in the end zone. That's why you got it, Golden Tate. Eagles up 1, but the Bears weren't done. Mitch Trubisky finds Allen Robinson to get it down to the 35. So Bears would set up a 43-yard field goal for Cody Parkey. And Parkey, who had just made this right before the Eagles called a timeout to ice him, misses it. Upright, crossbar, miss. Off the post. 6th time that's happened this season for Cody Parkey. Heartbreak in Chicago as the Eagles win the game 16-15. They are moving on to face the Saints next week. Here is Cody Parkey on that season-ending miss.
That's the worst, one of the worst feelings in the world to let your team down. So I feel terrible. You know, I'm going to continue to put things in perspective, continue to just put my best foot forward and just sleep at night knowing that I did everything in my power this week to go and make that kick. And for whatever reason, at the crossbar and the upright, and I still couldn't do it. So, yeah, I feel terrible.
I draw my strength from, you know, those guys in the huddle, just look in their eyes, the belief they have, not only in me, but in one another. And knowing that, you know, this was a crazy game. There's a lot of adversity. I mean, this is one of the most hostile environments I've played in. You know, their fans came out, and, you know, we still had a lot of support here too. But it was, you know, I'll sleep well tonight for sure.
CeCe, we've been doing this show together for a year and a half. I can count on one hand how many times something in the NFL has actually surprised you. Did this result surprise you, Eagles beating the Bears in the way they did it?
The result didn't surprise me. I mean, the way the game ended with a kicker that used to play with Philadelphia and kick very, very well for them, and the number of times that he's hit some part of the goalpost this year, and for it to end like that, now that was surprising, that was shocking, but this Philadelphia team is very, very talented. Their offensive line played probably their best game that they've played in a couple months yesterday, and not just in the numbers. They didn't run the ball and dominate, no, but they were going against the best defense that I would call the most frightening defense in the NFL, and they took advantage of some of the replacement that they had in the secondary. So, no, I wasn't surprised. Nick Foles did a good job, and they had a great game plan as far as getting the ball out of his hand, spreading the ball around to all the different receivers, trying to attack all parts of the field. I thought Philadelphia and their staff and this team collectively, if you look at the special teams, if you look at the defense, and now look at the offense, we give too much credit to the quarterbacks. I know we do it week in, week out, day in and day out. There's no way that you have to be surprised. This Philadelphia team, because they're very, very talented, that they would be able to go to Chicago, the least experienced team in the playoffs, and be able to win.
If you would ask me before the game who I expected to win, I'd have said the Bears. I picked the Bears. I think we all thought the Bears would win, so that part surprised me. If you'd asked me 10 minutes into the game how confident I am the Bears are going to win, I'd have said not very at all.
Why?
Because the moment Philly took that first drive down the field, I know they didn't get a touchdown, but I thought that opening drive was incredibly important, showing they could move the football, that they were not going, they had a game plan for Khalil Mack, and it wasn't going to be we have to double team him every play. They did a good job on Khalil Mack, as they've done on elite pass rushers over the last 6 weeks, holding guys like DeMarcus Lawrence, Aaron Donald, J.J. Watt, Khalil Mack, Ryan Kerrigan to a combined 1 sack and just 6 quarterback hits in 6 games against those guys leading into this game. Jason Peters did a good job. They did a good job scheming to where Khalil Mack couldn't wreck the game. And you saw, okay, Philly's going to be able to move the ball at least a little bit. If Philly's defense plays well and or if Mitch Trubisky plays poorly, this is going to be a tight game throughout. Now, with all that said, the Bears obviously could have won it. This is something where you've said many times before, it's things like this that make you, for lack of a better term, hate team sports. Like, now Mitch Trubisky gets labeled a can't win a playoff game. And I know he threw for 300 yards, but how many times did he almost throw the game away? And now he's 0-1 with a home playoff loss to a backup quarterback. But the narrative's totally flipped if Cody Parkey makes that field goal.
If he does his job.
Okay, yes, I know. You have no love lost for kickers that don't
do
their job.
I mean, besides his mom, his wife, or something, like, who is today?
No, I understand. So if Cody Parkey makes his field goal, which is his job, understand, then there is no more Nick Foles discussion. There's no more Foles versus Wentz. All of it. And this is, by the way, and here's where the Bears, speaking of guys doing their jobs, this is where the Bears front office, which has done a tremendous job, has taken a little bit of ownership of this. Going into the playoffs, which kicker had missed the most kicks in the NFL? Cody Parkey. Who's a guy that, of all the kickers this week, and aside from maybe the Badgley kids in Los Angeles with the Chargers, that you had the least confidence in? Cody Parkey.
Four times in that Lions game this season.
Cody Parkey. But they had given him a big extension this offseason. It's probably one of the reasons they stuck with him throughout the year, when kickers usually, if they're having a tough season, they're just gone. And now your season's over, and it's an enormous squandered opportunity for the Bears. But credit to the Eagles. Fourth and goal, season on the line, after they get stuffed on the goal line. If there was ever going to be a narrative that made sense, it's the Bears' defense in a goal line stand. That's how they move on. And Golden Tate, a guy that the Eagles front office went out and got. He made a play, and Foles made a throw.
Yeah, Golden Tate, I want you to watch this route that he ran, because he knew they were running. This is the most famous route. Bill Walsh ran this, called quick right sprint team, R17, where you put two of your receivers to the field, you sprint the quarterback, and he's going to throw the ball on timing right in front of the pylon, and the wide receiver decides. Golden Tate knows that the DB has outside leverage. He looks inside as if he's going to run a route inside, and then snaps it off outside. That's the overall experience, a veteran wide receiver in a critical situation, a great play call, taking advantage of a young player who didn't have much experience. And that Chicago secondary, it came into the game banged up, all right, and the Eagles were able to take advantage of these reserve players that were in the game.
Look, you and I talked earlier, and I said, what do you think about how Nick Foles played? And you said, the Eagles team played very, very well. But when we use the word, and we laugh when we say it, but when we use the word magical in Nick Foles, things like what happened with Cody Parkey, that folds into this, whatever is surrounding Nick Foles and his ability to get the team to play and to win. So I do have to ask what you thought of the way Nick Foles played and what this now means moving forward.
I thought this was Nick Foles, individually, his worst game of this run, his worst game of the must-win games. They've now won 7 consecutive elimination games with Nick Foles at the quarterback. This was clearly his worst game. Now, it was also clearly against the toughest defense he's faced. The only thing that would be close would be the Vikings defense in the NFC Championship game last year, but that Vikings defense hadn't been playing as well as of late as this Bears team had. I don't assign the Cody Parkey miss to anything with Nick Foles' magic. I will say the offensive line continues to play its best football this last month. You see the Eagles secondary, which had been terrible throughout the first 3 months of the season, I thought played an outstanding game yesterday, aside from some dropped interceptions that could have made this game a more substantial Eagles win.
Play defense.
And so I don't assign much to the Nick Foles magic as far as how the game ended, but I mean, they now have an opportunity to go into New Orleans, a place that with Carson Wentz, this Eagles team lost 48-7 in a game that we thought ended their season. It dropped them to 4-6, and they were written off for dead. We'll see if it can continue next week.
Yeah, I believe in Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and even we'll put out money for the Tooth Fairy. Mr. Tickles even likes that. But as far as believing that Nick Foles is on some magic carpet ride, that's what got him through Chicago, no, I'd be a fool to believe it. I've been on too many football teams. It's a team sport, and this is what happened. The team supported their quarterback. He threw a number of balls that should have gotten intercepted. The interception in the red zone. He shouldn't throw that ball or throw it out of bounds. Now, the defender got a little bit on his hand, so the ball came up a little bit short. They react because they was reading his eyes. The young linebacker, Roquan Smith, he reacts and jumps on one of his checkdowns, intercepts that. So when you throw two two interceptions, ain't no magic carpet ride. You got to be supported by your team. And that's what this offensive line did. That's what the defense did. Their secondary played amazing. The Philadelphia linebackers played their best game of the season. So when you're talking about a man, Nick Foles, his performance, thank God he had that defense. Thank God they get that deflection on that last kick to take a little bit off that kick so it hits the post twice. So I believe in team, and that's what the Philadelphia team did. They supported their quarterback. I know we'll give the quarterback all the credit all week, but I'll try to balance it out.
And this is where the unfairness of one game samples and single elimination plays out. Like, there is no rhyme or reason that the kick the kid missed was the one that counted, and the kick he made was the one where there was a timeout. Like, that's a coin flip. There are so many things that are just absolute coin flips, and this one, once again, it came up heads for the Eagles, as it has seemingly every time during this run.
All right, the Philadelphia Eagles win the wild card matchup. They now move on to face New Orleans next weekend. Take a break. Coming up, what was the key to the Cowboys taking down the Seahawks? We'll talk about that next. This is First Things First.
There's something about auctions that makes shopping so much more fun. For sports fans, it probably has something to do with the competition and suspense that auctions provide. But who wants to spend time researching where their nearest auction house is and then make the trek all the way there? I definitely don't. And that's why I love Pristine Auction, an online sports auction house where you can buy and sell sports memorabilia from the comfort of your own home. Pristine Auction runs tons of different auction formats, including multiple weekly auctions, a premium monthly auction, as well as daily and 10-minute auctions. They guarantee the authenticity of all of their items, and everything you purchase comes from only the most trusted sources. And the best part? It's so affordable. I just saw an autographed Ricky Stenhouse Jr. photo that sold for only $6. Go check out Pristine Auction now. You'll be hooked. It's free to register, free to bid, and you only pay for the items you win. That's pristineauction.com. And when you register, be sure to select First Things First podcast from the drop-down menu in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Let them know we sent you. Make sure you select First Things First podcast from the drop-down menu when you go to pristineauction.com.
Welcome back. We'll get to the Cowboys and Seahawks in a second, but first, Zion Williamson continues to defy gravity. The 360 dunk, the one he gave a 7 out of 10.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. If this is a 7 out of 10, an in-game 360 with his head above the rim, then what is a 10?
The reason why, because you can see his body is turned about a quarter before he even takes off. Watch his body. He'll be facing towards the sideline. You see that?
So it's a 270 instead of a 360.
But somebody do the math.
I just did it.
He knows it. He knows what he got to do. If he want to do a full 360, face the bucket, and then do it.
Bears, okay. Eagles, Nick Foles with the pass to Golden Tate, hey, who holds on despite a huge hit. Oh, the Eagles are happy they traded for him yesterday.
A lot of noise surrounding Golden Tate prior to this game, that he hadn't been as productive, that this was one of the midseason acquisitions where it looked like maybe the team trading the player away knew something the team getting him didn't know. He had two of the biggest plays, including the single biggest play of the game.
Cowboys, Seahawks, check out the stiff arm from Zeke.
And see, I know you love this, the heady play. This happened about 3.5 minutes left. Easily could have gone out of bounds. Cuts back inbounds to get another 40 seconds off the clock here with the Cowboys up 3 at the time.
Yeah, Zeke played a great all-round game, not only running the ball as a pass receiver, but one of the hidden gems when he was coming out of college was his ability to block. And you could see a couple times where they ran the quarterback, Zeke was one of the lead blockers, getting this guy on the ground. Physical game by Zeke. Talking about a guy who wants a new contract? Oh, and he earned one.
Same game, Cowboys threatening. K.J. Wright makes a great interception in the end zone for Seattle.
All right, see, I saw you tweeting about this. Is this one of those 60% interceptions that's on the receiver?
This is the quarterback's fault. The quarterback had plenty of space. He wasn't getting rushed. He should have let him so he can run away from the linebacker. It also should have been pass interference. Yeah. Now, a great recovery for an interception by one of the good linebackers that we have playing this game, but a number of things went, but it starts with the quarterback leading. Throw him into space, wide open. He'll run away from that linebacker.
All
right, let's get full highlights from this game. Dallas, Seattle. There's Dak. Everyone expecting a lot out of him. Cowboys down 4 in the fourth. Dak Prescott with a nice pass to Amari Cooper. That's a 34-yard gain. for Dak, his longest pass of the day. Four plays later, Zeke runs in the one-yard score. Dallas up three. Fast forward, less than 3 minutes to go. This is third and 14. This is Dak being all mobile and everything. Runs for the first down all the way to the one. Next play, he would run it in for the score. And there it is. Jerry Jones, super fired up. Cowboys pull out the 24-22 win. Here is Dak Prescott after his first playoff win.
This team, everything we've been through, we had so much confidence coming to the game, and our confidence remains. I mean, we just played a great, great Seattle team. Just honestly, it's just all about the way we fought, the way we compete through success and adversity. Proud of our guys.
Can we talk about the way this guy fought on third down, running it for 16 yards to get the first down and then set up the touchdown? I mean, what were you thinking when you saw him take off?
Simple. You're a grown man. That's what it is. That's how he played today, and he led us to this win.
All right, CC, bunch of happy guys right there. What was the key to the Cowboys beating Seattle?
I got to say Dak being able to run the ball in the fourth quarter, because to me that was the edge. When they had that third down and extremely long, a lot of bad things can happen. The defense, man, you're playing into their hands. They got less space to defend. They're not worried about you running the ball. They actually hope you run it, so then you kick the field goal on fourth down. This is not a first down play. Brilliant call by them, but it was to try to get the ball for an easy chip shot. If they get the easy chip shot compared to a touchdown, then Dallas could very easily lose this game. That touchdown drive and converting right there was the biggest play in the game. And Dak being heady enough to be able to, man, because he had a point where he could have gone to his left or right. He read the blockers, knew he had the guards on the linebackers, and knew he had his running back, and he decided to split them and to try to make that attempt. A lot of quarterbacks, they wouldn't do that. A lot of quarterbacks trying to manage their overall health and everything. So for me, Dak Prescott and his ability to accept that game plan and to be able to run that football when they needed, that third and 14 to me was the difference in a great football game.
See, it's not hyperbole to say it wasn't only the biggest play in this game. That is the biggest play by a Dallas Cowboy since Larry Brown picked off Neil O'Donnell in Super Bowl 30 to ice that game. That you might say, wait, how can you, it's 23 years since then? Well, think about it. They only won two playoff games since then. The one close call would be Terrence Williams' touchdown catch from Romo in their playoff win over the Lions. Like, this won them the football game. They were first and goal from the one. Like, they're going to score a touchdown. They're going to go up two scores, and they're going to win the game. And if you're Dak Prescott, at least at this point in his career, and I think it's probably fair to say even next year in his career, he's not going to be one of the five or eight or maybe even 10 best pure passers of the football. So the way he can create added value is things like this, is winning plays in the most critical moments. So like this touchdown drive combined with the 7-play, 75-yard touchdown drive to end the first half that got them in the end zone for the first time. Zeke had a huge 44-yard run on third and one on that play where Seattle had everyone compacted and he bounced it outside. Like, those are winning moments. In a game that Seattle had a very questionable game plan offensively, Dallas took advantage, and they stuck to who they were. Zeke had 30 touches. Dak made the one mistake we talked about, but aside from that, played a relatively clean game, avoided the critical sacks that killed him earlier in the year, and in the biggest spot, made the biggest play of the year, not only for the Cowboys, maybe in the NFL.
And that's what Zeke is talking about. When he talks about grown, man, he's talking about making good decisions. Like when they came into this league, and they have been through a lot. They've been under the microscope a lot, and this is their third season together, two postseason. But they were kids coming into them. Both of them have made mistakes on and off the field, some one for, and the other none. But that's what you expect on a Dallas Cowboy. When Jerry drafted these guys, he expected them to be in these big games, making those types of decisions and running the football the way Zeke did, because Zeke played like he was a grown man, and Zeke got it right as far as describing Dak and his decision-making in this football game.
Because Dak's numbers were pedestrian at best, but he found a way to win the game, which is all you can ask for in a quarterback, especially when you're looking at a quarterback for the future. On the other side of the ball, why couldn't Seattle pull this out?
If I'm Seattle and I'm Pete Carroll and Brian Schottenheimer and I start rewatching this, I understand who they've been all year as a running football team. But part of the reason they've been a running football team is they've been dominant running the ball. Yeah, they've averaged 35 rushes a game in the last 13 weeks. But that was for 170 yards. They were averaging 5 yards per carry in that stretch. They called this football game. They would have called it no different if Blake Bortles was their quarterback. Throwing was a last resort at all times, despite the fact that A, you have Russell Wilson, B, Dallas's defensive front was playing a tremendous game. It was very clear by midway through the second quarter they could not successfully run the ball on first and second down. Yet they tried to call runs on first and second down the entire game. They treated a pass like it was only for emergencies. Fourth and six, I guess we'll let him pass. And not shockingly, Russell makes a perfect pass. Down 10, 2 minutes left. I guess we're going to, like, they. I think they're going to regret not using their all-pro level quarterback more in this football game.
Yeah, I totally disagree with you. And the reason why, coming into this game, we knew. That was the same. Oh, if Seattle, they get behind, one thing we like about them is, oh, they're very patient. Oh, they'll stay with the running game. So now they've lost, so we're going to go back to the game and try to rewind it and be like, you know something, I believe they should be more aggressive. There are certain teams, Seattle being one of them, they only have a couple variances for which they can win offensively. And thinking that offensive line could back Russell up and pass 45 times, no. That defensive front was playing at a different speed. This was not a good matchup for Seattle. So I thought Dallas would take him out of their running game. But Russell being able to make one or two enough plays outside of, let's not forget the third and 14 we just saw. Mm-hmm. So if they settle for a field goal, how many plays does Russell need to make to be able to be able to lead them back? So you can't just change your style in the postseason just because it's the postseason, because your team, you have to tell them during the week how we're going to play. And if you don't play that way, it's hard for the team to have confidence in the coach. Pete Carroll and them had a style. Be physical. Brian Schottenheimer, they tried that. They changed it after the first couple games. It's what got them into this playoff run. And we can't fault them because they lost a game in the style that got them there. Because, I mean, how do we ever critique the coaches? Because everyone is getting scouted. So they were able to dominate them on the front. And you got to give Dallas's offensive defensive line credit for taking them out of the game plan.
The reason I think it's fair to critique them is because we ask coaches to make adjustments. If you've got an offensive lineman who's just getting whooped the entire game and your quarterback's getting sacked.
But it doesn't make it better for him, Nick. As your coach, how can I make that guy successful? Backing those offensive tackles up against Dallas is not the way. Because of their lack of talent on offense, that's why they have less variables, less change of pace. They only got a fastball and a curveball.
No, I get that part of it. When I was saying if you have an offensive lineman getting whooped, I was going to use a hypothetical one that didn't happen in the game. If you have an offensive lineman getting whooped in a generic game and your quarterback keeps getting sacked, you either roll the guy out away from him, you chip the guy, you find things to adjust in game. The inability to adjust in-game, that this running attack that has all year long worn people down, that has the last 13 weeks averaged 5 yards per carry, they had 20 rushes for 30 yards at one point in this football game. To not try the curveball a little more often, even if you only have two pitches.
But what is it, though?
What
we can't just make it up. Russell run the ball. Like if you would say, man, Russell, I believe Russell should have used his legs more, I would listen to that. But we can't just say, A, they should change to change to what?
Change to absolutely the ball in Russell Wilson's hands with his ability to run or pass. I thought that was obvious. That's what I was saying. That the best player on your team in this, because they were playing to get exactly what they almost got. You're right about that. They were playing, hey, down less than a touchdown, 2 minutes left, see what our quarterback can do. I didn't think they had to play a game where it was in that position. I thought they could have scored more earlier.
I think
in
Seattle,
the football game,
before the game, realized our offensive front is at a disadvantage going against their front seven. So how can I slow them down? How can I give Russell a chance? Russell was sacked one time. So they had enough plays. The defense has got to get off the field on that third down, and then that changes the argument. Russell Wilson and this offense, this offseason, they have to try to come up with some other things to make them more explosive, and they ran out of options in Dallas.
All right, time now for Put a Grade On. It's sponsored by CarMax. So Dak Prescott had a pretty nice day in his first playoff win as a Cowboy. Nick, put a grade on Dak Prescott's game.
That play right there gets you an A. I mean, that's if that was all he did the whole game, that play right there, that changed the course of the Cowboys season potentially, was the biggest play of the weekend. That gets you an A. So this is great easy for me.
Yeah, I'm going to give him an A plus. The Dallas Cowboys quarterback leading them to victory in the style for which he played. Hey, Dak, don't be trying to develop to be a drop back quarterback. Be a winning quarterback, and that's what he was able to get done in Dallas. That's why I give him an A plus.
All right, good stuff. Got to take a break coming up. Hey, how dangerous are Andrew Luck and the Colts right now? That's next on First Things First. On Sunday night, tune in to FS1 for a big super middleweight title fight as Jose Uzcategui defends his belt against undefeated Caleb Plant. It's live Sunday at 6:30 Eastern on FS1 and the Fox Sports app. All right, time for stories to start your morning. Well, basketball, Lakers snapped their three-game losing streak last night, beating the Mavericks 107-97. Brandon Ingram led the way with 29 points. Nick, what was your takeaway from this one?
Excellent second half by the Lakers in a game they needed. After struggling immensely without LeBron, looked like this was going to be a continuation of that trend. Down 15 at the half. Mm-hmm. Josh Hart hit a nice little buzzer beater right at the half. Gave him a little momentum. And Brandon Ingram, second most points he scored in an NBA game at 29. He hadn't been able to crack that 26-point threshold all year. Good game by him. Good game by Lonzo, despite Kuz struggling immensely in his game back.
Yeah, they're in the eighth spot in the West now. Man, it's critical that they try to just hold serve until LeBron gets back. But it's a dangerous time for them, man. They need to win a few games with LeBron being out of the lineup.
When's he
coming
back,
Nick?
Night.
I don't know. They're That's playing pretty home severe. Against the Cavs. You know, in 6 days, I don't
wish y'all listen to me about those injuries. LeBron said it, Pop. Man, this is not significant. Oh, you'll be back in a few days. Shh. Okay.
Excuse me. All right, let's move on to Jimmy Butler. The saga continues. Reports are he isn't happy with his role with the Sixers. This after not being happy with his role with the Timberwolves. But Philly's not giving up on him quite yet, according to more reports. The Sixers have refused calls from teams looking to acquire Butler. Nick, what'd you make of this?
Jimmy Butler needs to talk with somebody, get with somebody. I don't know if it's a life coach or just personality conflict coach. Jimmy Butler, what does Stink say? When everywhere you walk smells, maybe it's you. Like, Jimmy Butler, you had beef with people in Chicago. You had beef with people in Minnesota. You're not having beef already in Philadelphia. Maybe it's a Jimmy Butler problem. He carries himself like he's bringing this championship pedigree to any team he goes to. He's won two series, not championship series, in his career. Like, come on, Jimmy, chill out, man.
Well, I don't have a problem with this. And the reason why, because they do have an offensive problem. And it's a legitimate question. Now, how he presented that, and now because he's done these things in Minnesota, but they got an offensive problem. So he's got a high basketball IQ. And high basketball IQ guys, they will challenge the coaches. I didn't have a problem with him challenging, but he needs to be. You have to play with somebody, Jimmy. Yeah. It's a team sport. Yeah. All right? So they do need to get their offensive problems
Agreed
worked out.
That.
So that is legitimate.
All right, let's move back to the football now in the NFL. The Packers are reportedly hiring Titans offensive coordinator Matt LaFleur to be their head coach. LaFleur spent time with Sean McVay in L.A. before this past role in Tennessee. Chris, what'd you make of this hire?
I thought it was a good hire. And Matt LaFleur is one of those kind of guys, when you meet him 15 minutes, you think ultimately he's going to be calling the NFL offense, running some type of franchise. So I'm thinking, now they might have reached a little bit early for him, because he doesn't have the experience there in Tennessee. You're not going to see his skill set based on what they did in Tennessee. He will adapt. It will be more like Sean McVay and what they do with Los Angeles, but I believe a bright, young offensive mind who will challenge Aaron Rodgers. So I like the hire of the Packers, and I like the fact that they got out there fast and was able to get one of the better candidates immediately.
Yeah, one of the only benefits of firing a coach midseason is theoretically you get a jump start on this process. Packers took advantage of that. So people should know he was the quarterback's coach in Atlanta the year Matt Ryan won MVP and they went to the Super Bowl. He was with the Rams last season but wasn't calling plays. He was hired based on, I would imagine, his interview and the ideas he presented rather than the resume of what the Titans did this year offensively, because what the Titans did this year offensively was not impressive, but he didn't really have the quarterback situation or the receivers to be impressive. It's a risky hire by Green Bay to hire a first-time head coach for this last phase of Aaron Rodgers' career, but they took the risky
And this
path.
Is where NFL owners are going. Sean McVay didn't have the resume either. No. When he went to Washington, you're like, hey, what offense is he going to run? And then when he got to L.A., we saw a different offense. So that's what the Packers are hoping for.
All right, let's move on. To declare or not to declare, that is the question, if you're Dwayne Haskins. And it turns out the Ohio State quarterback who led the Buckeyes to a Rose Bowl win and a 13-1 record this season will declare. He'll enter the 2019 NFL Draft. Haskins is the presumptive favorite to be the first quarterback taken in the draft. Could be the first Big Ten quarterback selected in the first round since 1995. CeCe, how good can Haskins be?
Well, he's the best quarterback that's ever come from that institution. They've been playing football over 120 years. He's absolute by far the best thrower. People might have missed the season, 50 touchdown passes. Now, I don't like the fact only starting 14 or 15 games because typically we have seen quarterbacks be more successful in the pros. But given his situation, given that he can be a top 10, given that he is the first at his position, he's got to be able to come out of school, even though he doesn't have those 30 starts, 25 starts that we would like. He has a touch, has a big-time arm, is a competitor, is a great leader, is not a diva, not a high-maintenance guy. So if you want to have a young guy to be the face of your franchise for a number of years, I believe he's as good a prospect as we've seen come into the league in the last several years. So what he did at Ohio State and revamped that offense with Ryan Day, we hadn't seen that. Art Schlichter, 1982, last quarterback from Ohio State. You mentioned the Big Ten quarterbacks. That is just not a conference that produces a lot of NFL. I believe that Haskins is the brightest that we've seen in a long time.
That is a crazy stat. That no Big Ten quarterbacks have taken the first round since Kerry Collins in 95. I think people hear, they're like, what about Drew Brees? Drew Brees was the very top of the second round when he was taken by then the San Diego Chargers. But I'm pretty close with a prominent Ohio State alum who I might have gone to a game with last year, who even last year was talking about this kid, Dwayne Haskins. Even when they had four-year captain starting quarterback at the time, the name's escaped me, I forgot. The quarterback.
JT Barrett.
JT Barrett, thank you, apologies. Being told and people talking that when this kid gets on the field, he is going to change the way Ohio State traditionally plays football because of his ability to vertically pass the football.
Somewhat the situation Trevor Lawrence in Clemson.
Yes.
They were trying to take that offense to a different level. Pure drop back, big time thrower. That's what Clemson had. That's what Ohio State had in Haskins.
And so the only knock on him is experience. And so he could have come back for another year. You come back for another year, then you're maybe not the number one quarterback in your class. There's a lot of questions that come up. He had said about a month ago in an interview, because he's from the tri-state area, New Jersey, I think, that he would love to be taken by the Giants. Now, it was kind of a leading question. The Giants are the type of situation that could be ideal for him because of the lack of experience, where it's not a team that wants him to start immediately, where he can learn from a veteran quarterback and then take the reins either midseason or in year two. Because I believe in the talent. I do think it's very difficult for quarterbacks that only start the 1 year in college to come in and instantly make an impact. Mitch Trubisky was in a similar position.
Sure.
He's still getting his footing, and he's played a couple years of pro football at this point.
And you think his game translates to the pros pretty well?
Oh, he can throw it. He can throw it to any part of the field. He's got touch on the short passes, intermediate we saw during the season, and being able to read coverages and not throw interceptions. He's got a big arm, but he doesn't take a lot of chances with the football. Still throwing in single digits as far as interceptions with those 50 touchdowns. Pretty special. I believe he's going to be a really good pro.
All right, let's move back to last night's game again. Yesterday, we wondered what it would take for Clemson to pull off the upset over Alabama. The answer was Trevor Lawrence. Oh, and a great all-around Tigers team. They beat the Crimson Tide 44-16 behind nearly 350 passing yards out of Trevor Lawrence. It is Clemson's second national title in 3 years, the first 15-0 season in modern college football history. Clemson Tigers are your national champs. Here's Clemson's head coach, Dabo Swinney, after the win.
There was a lot of talk about best ever all year long. We were never in that conversation. But tonight, there's no doubt. You know, first 15-0 team to beat Notre Dame and to beat Alabama to do it. This team won 13 games by 20 points or more and led by an unbelievable group of seniors.
One game doesn't define who you are. But I also told the players that sometimes we learn more when things don't go well, when we lose. You have to learn how to lose as well as how you win. And there's a lot of lessons for us to learn from the experience that we had in this game. whether you're a senior who's leaving or whether you're a player who's coming back, and you see that we have work to do.
All right, Nick, when you look at what Clemson did not only this year but what has been doing the last couple years, can you now put these two programs on equal footing?
I think you have to in the right here and now. Over the last 4 years, they're both 55-4. They're both two times champions. They're both in the playoff every single year. They're 2-2 against each other. And I think more importantly than what I think, what the young athletes think, what the high school players think, that Clemson has on their rosters, freshmen this year. The number one player from Ohio, got a pretty damn good football school in Ohio. They got the number one player from Alabama, they got a pretty good football school in Alabama. And what Dabo Swinney has done is, to me, the only thing I can compare it to is what Coach K did at Duke when he took over a team that was not a blue blood, that was not one of these all-time great programs, and turned it into one. If at the beginning of this decade, when Nick Saban had already won a title in Alabama and was setting up this infrastructure, if you'd have come to me or I think anyone and said, hey, there's going to be one team that by the end of the decade is toe-and-toe, neck-and-neck with Alabama, year in, year out, people might have said SC, they might have said Oklahoma, they might have said Ohio State, they might have said Texas, might have said Florida.
Not Clemson.
Clemson wouldn't have been one of the first 15. Clemson, yeah, they won a national title in 81. They before this run, they had the same history of 25 other college football programs in a place that hasn't been historically a hotbed to recruit from for them. They're competing with SEC schools. Like, what he has done there is remarkable. It has created a new powerhouse program in college football out of nearly thin air. So right now, contemporaneously, they and Alabama are clearly neck and neck. And what he is doing in remaking what Clemson football is, to me, is nothing short of remarkable.
Yeah, there's a lot of good programs in college football. But right now, the creme de la creme happens to be Clemson and Alabama. And last week, in talking with Ryan Day, and in the last couple of days, because we got a lot of kids, they're going to come out of school, and I've been just conversating with the coach. He's recruiting Ohio, and he's recruiting the nation, but it's in with Clemson and Alabama in mind. He's saying, yeah, I need kids. I want kids from Ohio. Yeah, I want kids from around the nation. Yes. But if these kids can't help me beat Clemson and Alabama, that's the standard in college football. And with Ohio State having one of the top five programs, one of their coaches telling me, yes, I think everyone else in college football should recognize Clemson and Alabama, they are a step above Georgia, Texas, Ohio State, and Michigan. And these other schools are going to have to, from a quarterback standpoint, be able to protect that quarterback and getting after the quarterback. You're going to have to be able to match what these teams have been able to do. And what I think is more important, especially with the retirement of Urban Meyer, there's only one coach on the level of Nick Saban, right, and that's Dabo Swinney. All the other, there is no other. There are no legendary coaches in college football. Dabo Swinney and Nick Saban are the only two on that level. Everyone else is aspiring to get to that level. So not only from a coaching standpoint, because that helps recruiting.
Sure.
All right? Because you can go in there and say, yeah, man, we stood eye to eye with the Beast four times in the last several years, and we whooped them twice. That right there is the best stat that Clemson has going for him.
And the other schools we've seen go on a, you know, 4 or 5 year run, they either had historical or infrastructure recruiting advantages. We saw what Urban did at Florida, that unbelievable run. But it is not, it shouldn't have been shocking to anyone that you get an all-time great head coach in a place like the University of Florida that he can build a juggernaut. We've seen what the University of Miami has done multiple times over the last 30 years, what SC did under Pete Carroll. All of those made sense to me. Like what Oklahoma, I know they only won the one title with Stoops, but what they were able to do in, year out, being a top five team. Florida State with Bowden. Like, all yeah. those things made sense. For the reason I brought up the Coach K example is, for a guy to take over a smart kid school in Chapel Hill backyard, North Carolina's backyard, and then all of a sudden make them the premier program in college basketball, how does that happen? Clemson, to do what he's done in the SEC's backyard, in a school that had always been a second-tier football school compared to the top teams, is remarkable to me.
How did he do it? What can you pinpoint and say, well, this is where it really changed, or this is where it really happened, or this is where the school really made the turn?
Yeah, Clemson's had a lot of good players for a long, long time, and they've been in the ACC. That's been dominated by Florida State. But when you look at what's been happening from a population standpoint in the United States, a lot of people are moving south. A lot of the factories and stuff closed down. Yep. So Pennsylvania, Ohio, and all these, all the population, it's been affected. There's less human bodies in the North than in the South. So people have populated to the South, and University of South Carolina have not taken advantage of that being a hotbed. South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, within a 600-mile radius, there is a bunch of good football players. So Clemson was very, very close. Dabo Sweeney. Dabo is a special personality, a great leader, and now they've been able to get the quarterback, the prototype. They had Deshaun Watson, and now they have Lawrence. So when you can do those types of things, stack recruiting class on recruiting class, and he's got really, really good big people. Great offensive line and depth on the defensive line that stood together
for
4 or 5 years.
What Alabama was known to be able to do, recruiting class on recruiting class.
Oh, absolutely. Like, that is, you want to know who's going to be in the top 10 in college
football. College football is about recruiting.
Yeah, look, you want to know who's going to be in the 2019 top 10. Go look at the 2015 Rivals recruiting rankings. Like, you want to know and look at the top 10 there. That is, those things, it is all about getting the players, but then it's also about developing the players, and that's where the university gets credit. They've given, the other advantage Saban has always had is, or I shouldn't say always had, but has had recently is, you have the ability to pay coordinators like coaches, head coaches at some places, position coaches like coordinators. What'd you say Brent Venables makes?
Oh, over $2 million as a defensive coordinator. Wow. So now they have the resources.
Yeah.
They have the facilities. There's nothing you can use against them negatively as far as recruiting. Man, Clemson is here to stay, and Dabo Sweeney, that, like, you don't have to worry about recruiting against him because, oh, he's going to go to his alma mater. He played at Alabama, but he's at home in Clemson, so he's going to be there for a long, long time.
It's his dream job. Like, it's at least it's turned into his dream job. It's not the – there is not a job you could offer Dabo Sweeney that he would say, I want to leave Clemson.
No,
for.
Not because it's two national championships that come against beating Alabama.
Right. So, I mean, he has made them into the – it's and for, to win the game the way they want it, because the first two games were coin flip games. Either team could have won it, but they could have lost them both. Last year they got beat soundly. To whoop Alabama the way they did last night was as impressive a performance I've seen in college football in a very long time.
Guys.
Yeah.
This with you two. My dream job.
Oh, thank you, Jenna Wolf. We don't have to worry about her going anywhere, see?
I'm over here, see? Right over here. Just like 3 degrees this way. Gotta take
my
a break.
Dream job.
Awesome. That went well. Coming up, how can the
you
Eagles...
tell the truth, stop lying on TV.
I am not lying on TV.
I didn't make it 24.
How did the Eagles pull off the upset in the Superdome? Malcolm Jenkins has the answer ahead on First Things First. Back here, First Things First, look who's here. Former Pro Bowl quarterback Brandon Flowers, who CC called great guy and very handsome.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Now you can say
been,
instead
I've been
of me.
Since he was a kid.
This is one of the frustrating things about working with Chris Carter. It's a good thing, but it's frustrating. I saw we were having B-Flow on the show. I come into the morning meeting, I'm all excited. I'm like, man, I've known Brandon for 12 years. You've known him since he was a rookie in Kansas City.
Day.
Him and B. Carr, the whole. And Chris, like, man, I used to babysit him. I knew him when he was 14 years old, training.
Yes, I won some money in high school.
I grew up in a game under Chris. He taught us how to be sharp, approach the game a certain way. So, yeah.
We got our hair cut the same spot
exactly.
for the same time.
Exactly.
I mean, but this is the thing, though. When we came to Fox, I was like, hey, Nick, you want a radio show? He'd be like, yeah, I'm excited a radio show. He'd be like, hey, you got Chris Carter. You want a TV show? So
yeah,
that's how things happen.
Again, I'm not complaining.
He's complaining.
Just living the life. I ain't complaining.
We are happy to have you, Brandon. Sit back, relax. Let's talk some football. All right, here we go, Brandon. Two of the best quarterbacks of our generation will match wits this weekend when Philip Rivers and the Chargers head into Foxborough to take on Tom Brady and the Patriots. It'll be the first time the two have faced off in the playoffs in over a decade. Brady called this game the most important 3 hours of the season, and he's right for him. Rivers says while he is looking forward to the matchup, he knows he has to be focused on much more.
I got to focus on that defense. Nah, I'm not playing Tom by any means. But is it special to go to New England against a Hall of Fame coach and arguably the best quarterback ever to play and get another shot at him? Heck yeah. Heck yeah, it is. It is special. And, just like I always told you, look over and it's Peyton Manning, you know, on the other side. I'm not playing those guys, but I have a great deal of respect, fan of those guys, you know. And so to get an opportunity again to go against them 11 years after we had that opportunity in, you know, the 2007 season, it's awesome and looking forward to it.
Already talks like a coach. All right, Brandon, if the Chargers are going to go into New England and pull off the upset, how are they going to do it? What's going to be the key to this game?
The key to the game is hitting Brady.
this team gets pressure with Joey Bosa, Melvin Ingram. They throw so many different looks at you, like the Ravens last week. 7 DBs. You don't know where the blitz is coming from. And let's be clear. The Chargers are the best team coming in here, and they know it. You know, they can play defense, they can run the football, and they got a quarterback that's been there before.
So you're saying if you roster the roster, man, the Chargers, you like their roster talent more so than New England.
I love the Chargers roster. They have the top two rosters in the NFL, in my opinion. They can match up on the outsides with anybody. Gus Bradley is a great defensive coordinator. And who do you want besides Phillip Rivers to go in there and shoot out with Tom Brady? Well, I think they built to beat the New England Patriots.
Man, a couple things. Gus Bradley made a huge adjustment last week. He had a couple safeties in the box, played 7 DBs. Going into Gillette this week, would you come up with that game plan and something else, or how would you attack them?
You have to come in with the same game plan because you can blitz out of 7 DBs on a field, and Tom Brady won't know where it's coming from. Tom Brady loves to hit the running backs out of the backfield. You don't want linebackers matched up against these guys. You want safeties that can run and tackle in space.
So even though we played 58 snaps with these DBs, you're going to present that to Brady. I know you're going to have a plan B, but you're saying let's start the game with the 7 same DBs that we had success with the Ravens.
You have to. You can't let Tom Brady get going and then try to adjust. Have these DBs on the field. These DBs are hungry. We wanted to do this when I was playing at San Diego. I'm glad Gus Bradley has trusted Ron Miles, the DB coach, to put these guys on the field and let them just go out and play and have fun.
And I want people to understand how unprecedented what the Chargers did this past weekend was. I was listening to Robert Mays yesterday on his podcast, and he brought up the exact number. So they played 58 of 59 snaps with 7 defensive backs. We said that on the show yesterday. What I didn't know was across the entire NFL this season, all 256 games of the regular season, no team had played more than 18 snaps with 7 defensive backs in a game. So this was talking about something no one was prepared for. Nobody had played more than a quarter of a game in this personnel. They played the entire game. That can't work unless you have elite safety play. They have a first-team All-Pro, Derwin James. Adrian Phillips played out of his mind. You happen to be blessed in playing in some secondaries with some outstanding safeties. As a corner, what does having a safety that can do a little bit of everything, play a little linebacker even when he's playing safety, what does it allow for you to do, and what versatility does it allow for the defense?
You can run so many different coverages because you have safeties on this team that can cover, they can blitz, but get to the quarterback, not just sending a body. Derwin James, when he blitzes, he gets home every time. Adrian Phillips, he's a ball hawk. You know, he's either stripping the ball, he's getting interception. If you blitz Desmond King out of the nickel, he gets to the he gets home every time.
He's got great speed.
So it's just so much these guys can do and do well. You just don't do it. They get home when you send them on blitzes.
Brendan, I know you said roster to roster you like this Chargers team, but this is a Chargers team. Phil Rivers hasn't beaten Tom Brady yet in his career. They're going into Gillette where, I mean, the Patriots have been fantastic at home this year. They haven't lost a game at home.
They're only undefeated.
Is there something about that lure, if you will, that can be intimidating to, I would say, a young team or, you know, younger guys on the team, but just the team as a whole when you're the visiting team?
I think the fact that Phillip Rivers haven't won there is why he will get the win. He's a revenge type of guy. You can see the fire in his eyes. In his interviews, he can't wait to step on that field. I know all during practice, he's just twitching to get in that stadium and get the job done. He's going to go in there relentless.
Give us a little insight, because I know you signed there as a free agent. He didn't know you, but I know you're a guy. You like to talk. You're very, very competitive. What were the practices like, and what was Phillip Rivers? Because I know some of his sound bites of him talking trash in the game, I mean, they're one of a kind. He says a lot, but he never uses profanity. So what is it like going against a veteran a quarterback like him?
You know how you hear some players that they practice like they playing a game? This guy does it to the T. I'm talking about talking in practice, calling out blitzes. He can look at the defensive line and just let you know where blitz is coming. He'll shout to the defensive coordinator, "I know what blitz you in," and he'll strike a pass to light it up. So I can't wait to see this guy go on the field. With him fired the way he is, with Tom Brady, how fired this guy is, it's going to be fireworks out there.
And he mentioned the last time they got a chance to play the Pats in a game like this. It's 2007. How long ago was that? Since then, you have been drafted, played, retired, gotten into television. Since Phillip Rivers last had a chance. Like, I thought you said it in passing, Jenna. I think it's really noteworthy. Phillip Rivers played Tom Brady 7 times in his career. 0-7. And they've had some good teams now. They've had LaDainian Tomlinson. They've had a couple teams that were the one or the two seed. Has never been able to beat the Pats. For Phillip Rivers, the only thing missing from his resume is a Super Bowl appearance, Super Bowl championship. The numbers, the reason that when we talk about that draft class, he very often is the third name mentioned is because Big Ben's got the stats and the rings. Eli's got the rings against Tom Brady twice. Phillip Rivers just has the regular season success. Doesn't have, has one deep playoff run to the AFC Championship game. They play with torn ACL. It's not an exaggeration to say this is the biggest game Phillip Rivers played in over a decade. This is the second biggest game he's played in his entire career. And I agree with you on the talent. I think the Chargers, I think the Patriots were rooting so hard for the Texans. They wanted the Texans. They wanted Bill O'Brien. Exactly. They did not want to have to face either that Ravens defense or this Chargers well-rounded team. And I'm curious to see that the story see was the what the DBs did in that game. But what the DBs did doesn't work if those D linemen aren't dominating the Ravens front. Melvin Ingram, Joey Bosa, those guys.
Yeah, I expect the defensive front to be able to get after it. But I'm a little different than B. I need a couple different looks for Tom Brady. All right? I believe that the DBs match up well with the wide receivers. As you mentioned, none of the wide receivers from New England are going to scare you. But I need a curveball. I need a screwball. I need something else for Tom Brady to give him more looks than they did in Baltimore, because this is not Lamar Jackson.
All right, Brandon, stick around. Got to take a break. Coming up, what can the Colts do to slow down Pat Mahomes? Next on First Things First. Back here, First Things First, Super Bowl champ Chris Cannon joins us.
What up,
and
what up,
we have about a minute by the time you sit down to when we come back from a commercial break. And we always learn something new about Chris Cannon. Today's little nugget of news, he was voted most likely to succeed by his high school mates.
Well, that's news to you, Jenna. It's not news to anybody else.
That's a very good point.
I mean, if anybody knows me, they know I was going to hit it big one way or another.
Well, you know,
just in case this football thing didn't work out, we got other ways to make it happen.
That's why he didn't go to a football school.
Right.
Because he could get a good academic background at the University of Virginia.
Throughout the show, we'll tell you what all of our senior superlatives were. Kenny, last time the Saints and Eagles played, it was a tale of two cities.
I had a job opportunity I had to get to. I had to break some rules to
get
there.
Most likely to have a meeting with the FBI.
Me.
By any means necessary.
Sorry, Jenna.
Last time the Eagles and Saints met, it was a tale of two cities. It was the best of times for New Orleans, and it was the worst of times for Philadelphia. Saints won 48-7. But that was then, with an Eagles team riddled with injuries and quarterbacked by Carson Wentz. This is now, where the Eagles are playing their best team ball, quarterbacked by Nick Foles. Jason Peters said the Saints ran up the score on them in the first matchup and, quote, it is definitely not going to be the same outcome this time around. Chris Kenny, how much has changed since the Saints dominated the Eagles back in week 11?
Well, a few things have changed, Jenna. First of all, I'm going to start with the secondary, okay? Remember, Jalen Mills and Ron...
The Eagles secondary.
Yeah. Jalen Mills and Ron Darby, they got injured around the halfway point of the season, and this is that week 11 matchup when they played the Saints. The Saints put up 373 yards passing and four touchdowns. I think that's in large part because that secondary hadn't had a lot of experience playing with one another. We talk about how important continuity is for the offensive line, but I think the second group on a football team where it's probably the most important is that secondary. So Cravon LeBlanc, Avante Maddox, Rasul Douglas, those guys have got several games under their belt. And so now I think they'll be in better position to be able to communicate, adjust to what the Saints are throwing at them from a personnel and formation standpoint, and get that part of it shored up so they don't allow the big plays in the passing game. Offensively, the Eagles are going to have Darren Sproles back, and that's huge. If you look at Darren Sproles in that Texans game, being a release valve for Nick Foles, being able to dump it off for a swing pass for a touchdown, Darren Sproles can do that for your offense. And when we're talking about an Eagles offense that struggles to have consistency in the running game, I think you use that short passing game as an extension of the running game. That's going to take some pressure off of Nick Foles, and that's going to allow them to sustain drives. If you look back at that matchup that they had in the regular season, the Eagles didn't get their first down until the Saints already had 17 points on the board. So I think that's going to be important in terms of being able to control the complexion of the game. So those two factors, I think they bode well for the Eagles moving forward.
Well, and you mentioned members of the secondary who had been injured or were not yet fully immersed in the playbook. One guy who was out there and was fully immersed and was ready for what was coming at him and still couldn't handle it was Malcolm Jenkins. And he is also the guy who I think took this game the most personally. He won a Super Bowl in New Orleans. He is one of the most respected guys in the league. He knows Sean Payton. And he was angry with what they were doing at the end of this football game. We know that because he flipped the double birds to the New Orleans sideline near the end of the game. And if bulletin board material matters, if motivation matters, if revenge in sports matters, well, then the Eagles are, as amped as any team's going to be for the chance to go play in a conference championship game, add a little something to that. Because they were humiliated. And it was after this game that basically everyone on television, I'll raise my hand first, ended their season for them. That we said, okay, this is when your Super Bowl defense ended. When you are below 500 at this point in the year, you just got humiliated on national television. And we see the gap between the best team in the conference and you. And it is as substantial a gap as you could possibly have. But it's a totally different team now. The pass rush is back. The offensive line is playing like it did last year, except now they do have Jason Peters. Mm-hmm. And the quarterback play right now is better than it was in that game when Carson Wentz had his worst game of his career. Zero touchdowns, three picks, 160 yards. So it is a very – you can take something from the matchup, but I think what the Eagles take from it is the awful taste in their mouth they got. And I don't know if there's many learning points for the Saints from it.
And, CeCe, if you're going to talk about teams changing – the Saints' offense actually got worse over the course of the last couple of weeks. So between the Eagles getting better and shoring up that secondary a little bit and the Saints' offense slowing down, I know their defense has played great, you have much more of a competitive matchup here.
Yeah, all you guys make some great points. Jenna, the most important point, the end of the season, how is this Saints' offense different since that week number 11? They're totally different. Nick talking about as far as revenge, being a motivating factor in these games, it is a motivating factor. And one reason why I believe in this, and I want Chris Canty's opinion because I've seen him be involved in something like this. When you lose the first matchup, you have a competitive advantage going into the second matchup. It's because if you've been embarrassed or humiliated, when you look at the tape, you look at it totally different than they look at the tape. The Saints coaching staff and Sean Payton's going to have a challenge of, wow, if I change anything – because we annihilated them. Mm-hmm. If I change something, then the guys, if it doesn't work, then guys are going to be like, wow, why'd we change it when we had stuff that worked? Now, from the opposition standpoint, Doug Peterson is going to have no problem getting their attention. Jason Peters, the left tackle, he let us know. Malcolm Jenkins, he let us know. So they are going to have a little extra sauce going into this game. But to me, the equalizer is the Saints rested. The Saints are at home. The Saints do have Teddy Ginn back to that offense who will give them some type of spark. And they have the number one quarterback for me in throwing the football. If it's going to be tight and I need one guy to throw the football, I want Drew Brees. As far as all the guys left in the tournament, I want Drew Brees throwing it. So you guys make good points. Chris, what do you think about that revenge and playing a team that second time? Because you've been involved in a situation like this.
Yeah, I've been involved in a situation like this. The 2011 Super Bowl Giants, I mean, we went on that run in the postseason. But you look at that NFC Championship game, we had had a matchup with the San Francisco 49ers out in Candlestick Park earlier in the regular season. And so we knew what kind of game we had to play going back out there for a second time in that season. And in the end of that game, you saw that there was a pivotal third and short. And San Francisco, that team under Jim Harbaugh, they had prided themselves on being a tough, rugged bunch. And we knew that it was going to be a physical ball game. And I think if you look at that third down where we were able to get that stop, I think that was huge for us in terms of being able to build momentum and actually win that game. We saw something similar with the Dallas Cowboys, understanding the kind of game they had to play against the Seattle Seahawks because they took an ugly L in Seattle earlier in the regular season this year.
Yes.
And
you
saw they bounced back and they played a very physical game, both sides of the ball. I think that's something that bodes well for the Eagles in terms of being able to go in with a certain type of mentality, knowing what kind of game it's going to be, knowing what kind of environment it's going to be in the Superdome.
Who do you think is going to win?
I think the Saints are going to win. Drew Brees has not lost a playoff game down in the Superdome, but I think it's going to be closer than the experts think.
Especially more closer than the first time around, too. Chris, stick around. Coming up, can Andrew Luck take down the Chiefs at Arrowhead? That's next. This is First Things First. To Andrew Luck in
Indianapolis.
Why for an Olympic sport, gold medalist.
Yeah. I'm the best athlete.
Make
in my
me look bad in front of Candy. That is true. Their prize for taking out the Texans last weekend, one of the most dangerous offenses in NFL history, in the Kansas City Chiefs, led by possibly the MVP of the league this season in Patrick Mahomes, in perhaps one of the loudest and toughest venues to play at Arrowhead. It's going to be a stinking challenge, Candy. That's what Andrew Luck would probably say. Both quarterbacks were asked about this matchup yesterday.
It's single elimination. It's an intensity that you have to go into knowing that you got to put your best foot forward. And we know that. But at the same time, we're going to be ourselves. We're going to do what we've done all season long and try to execute at a high level and try to win a football game.
We're in the same mode we've been in for a while. One, today it's about improving. It's about being 1% better, 1% better, 1% better. And the goal at the end of the week is be 1-0. And you've heard us say that before, and we've lived it. And maybe there's a little more chatter outside, but that doesn't affect how we prepare. It doesn't affect what we do, how we operate. And so the focus has been great so far and will continue to be that way.
When you grow up, you want to go and play games like this. When you get older, you want to be a professional athlete and you want to win on the biggest stage. And so for me, it's about going out there, and like I said, be myself, lean on my teammates, and try to go out there and win a big football game.
All right, Chris Caney, when you look at these two quarterbacks, they're very different, Andrew Luck and Patrick Mahomes, both very successful, pivotal parts of their team's success this year. But now we're in the playoffs. It's a whole different ballgame. Which of these two do you trust more?
Well, I trust the quarterback that has playoff experience. If you look at this past weekend, wild card weekend, the quarterbacks that didn't have any playoff experience struggled. So, I mean, I think that's important. There's something to be said for that. And this is Andrew Luck's fourth postseason. I think this is his seventh postseason game.
It is.
So, of course, experience matters in these types of situations. You also have to factor in momentum. The Indianapolis Colts have a lot of momentum. They've won 10 of their last 11 games. When you look at the Kansas City Chiefs, December wasn't necessarily the best month. Their last four games, they're 2-2. So I just think that there's the potential for that Kansas City Chiefs team to get off to a slow start. And Nick, you mentioned it, in all the losses that the Chiefs have had, Pat Mahomes has gotten out to a slow start. So that's one of the things that concerns me. Also, weather is going to be a factor in this game. There's snow in the forecast. So, I mean, you look at this Chiefs offense and you talk about them playing basketball on grass and being one of the fastest, more up-tempo offenses in the National Football League. Bill Parcells used to say a cold player is not a fast player. So it'd be interesting to see how that offense reacts and responds under those conditions. I feel like the Colts, they have more ways they can win offensively than the Kansas City Chiefs. I like the consistency with them being able to run the ball, provide balance with Marlon Mack. Both teams, both offensive lines do a great job of keeping the quarterbacks upright, but I just feel like the Colts have more dimensions to their offense than the Chiefs at this juncture.
Right. I believe that the Colts, I think you make a great point, too, as far as Patrick Mahomes, what is he going to have to assist him? Like, we don't know. We don't know with Andy Reid if they're going to run the football. And if we just know that Patrick, they're just going to be one-dimensional. They're going to throw the football. Now, they got the best receiving core and quarterback combination in the league. But if the weather's bad, if it's windy, if the game is slowed down to a pace less than those 35 points, is he able to be patient enough? So, yes, those seven games of playoff experience, they do come in. But I know that the Colts are going to run the ball. And more importantly, I know the Chiefs are going to give up 5 yards a carry. So for me, the reason why I can say I would lean towards Luck is because I believe he's going to have more help that I know. Mm-hmm. I don't know about Andy Reid. Andy Reid will come out the first half, and they'll have 10, 12 rushing attempts. I'll be like, okay, that's what Patty Mahomes needs. But there's a case to be made for the hottest player in the NFL that's supported not only by play calling, but by how they're going to attack a defense. There's a case for Patty Mahomes going with the hottest player and them being rested and them potentially being the best team in the NFL.
Listen, I saw this narrative stream coming 2 weeks ago. When I said then, and I think it's being proven out now, no matter who the Chiefs drew in this round, if it was the Ravens, a team that went to Arrowhead and nearly beat them, the Chargers, the only team to go to Arrowhead and beat them.
Yes.
Or a red-hot Colts team, that the hot upset pick of the weekend was going to be whomever against the Chiefs. Because the playoff history, as far as the team, terrible playoff history at home is a real thing, and the lack of playoff experience for the quarterback is a real thing. Despite the lack of experience, Pat Mahomes didn't have experience at anything going into this year. put up the third greatest quarterbacking season ever. The Chiefs offense as a unit had never been together like this, put up the third highest scoring season ever. And at Arrowhead this year, they lost one game. And that game, they had a 14-point fourth quarter lead, and they lost it on a two-point conversion with 4 seconds left. So color me as someone that says the Colts do a lot of things really well. They are not as good as the Chiefs. They do not have home field advantage. They do not have a coaching edge in this game, and they do not have a quarterback edge in this game.
Are you not concerned about their defense?
I don't think you could be – I don't think there's a team you can play in the divisional round that doesn't bring a lot of concerns. I think everyone left is good. I think no matter – every matchup, there are things that would concern me, right? No matter who – what team you're talking about, there are teams the opposition brings. There's no dead ducks left playing in this round. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think the Colts have a good defense. I think their ability – to keep Andrew Luck upright when the only thing the Chiefs defense does well is attack the passer, mm-hmm. that's a concern. But if the Colts are going to come to Arrowhead and win, barring a blizzard, because I know there's some snow in the forecast, but I don't know how torrential of a downboard torrential snow. Barring horrible weather, you want to come to Arrowhead and win, go score 38 points. I think that's what you're going to need. This Chiefs offense going to put up their 35. I believe that. I know we're coming off a playoff weekend where no one broke 25. I believe this right. Chiefs
and
offense
And NFL
is
history would say that the best offenses, they're not going to win a Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. I happen to be on one of those offenses. We were high-flying. Yep. Man, what, two times we didn't score more than 27? Those only two games that we lost that season.
But we're not to the Super Bowl yet, right? I mean, that team was a field goal away from making the Super Bowl.
But this Colts team is better than the teams you guys would typically be facing in the divisional round. And I just, Nick, you cannot time a possession.
Yes.
And when you lose that in the playoffs, all right, we know the Chiefs will turn the ball over. Now, if you tell me, man, Damian Williams is going to run the ball, I've been like, okay, the Chiefs are going to be tough to beat. But we don't know what Andy Reid is going to do. We don't know if they're going to have some balance. And we don't know if Patty Mahomes in a tight, back-and-forth playoff game that he can matriculate and make chess moves with one of the better quarterbacks. Andrew Luck, 39 touchdowns on the season, even though people have not noticed.
Yeah, and the other thing to that, CC, and we talk about that division loss that the Chiefs had at home against the Chargers late in the season, they had a double-digit lead in the fourth quarter.
Yes, they did.
And it was a situation where they couldn't sustain drives. They couldn't close out the game.
One drive.
With their 4 minute offense. They couldn't. And he took a sack on that drive. You're right. You're absolutely right. I'm just saying Pat Mahomes and that offense, they could not close the door on that Chargers team. They allowed them an opportunity to get back in the game.
There should always be question marks when you've never done it in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Why should we believe that someone is just going to run through? We saw the offensive output in the NFL. Man, astronomical. The numbers, September, October. I told them, November, they started to slow down. Nope. December, they slow. Now they're down to a, man, the football game has changed. Can Kansas City play the same style, 35 points a game, in the postseason? Because if they're able to do that, that is hard to match.
And you were proven 100% correct about that. Wait till the weather changes and see if everyone's still scoring 40. Mm-hmm. And that has been proven out. And the first weekend of the playoffs was a great example of this, where no one could score 25. See, this is the stat you had yesterday. Mm-hmm. September through November, games 48 points per game. December, 43. January, including this postseason, down to 36. You see the passer rating dipping. I get all of it. I don't think that the reason that I have confidence in the Chiefs more than most is not only home field and rest, but they aren't just a 2018 really good offense. They're the third highest scoring offense in NFL history. The previous two didn't win the Super Bowl, but they got there. 07 Pats, mm-hmm. 2013 Broncos. They didn't win it, but they didn't lose a home playoff game either. They got there.
I don't think anyone's doubting whether Patrick Mahomes is capable of an offensive, you know,
fight.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. at any level, at any game. But I think it's what you brought up earlier this week. There's a difference, Chris Candy, between winning a point and wowing a point. Winning a drive and wowing a drive. Getting the 3 yards to get a first down and stay on the field and drive your team down the field, or trying to go for the big play, the big home run play, because the whole entire stadium is going to be there with the atmosphere, and it's going to be snowing. It's going to be crazy, and the energy. And you wonder if that's going to get to him, to make him want to always go for the big wow play and not just win the point. I think that's where a little bit of the experience comes into play.
No, you're absolutely right, Jenna. And this Kansas City Chiefs team is led by their offense. And you know that the defense is one of those areas where they're shaky at. So that's why I put so much emphasis on this Chiefs offense being able to close the game out late when they have a lead, because you know – that if they leave the door open for Andrew Luck and that Colts offense, that going up against that defense, there's the potential that they could make the plays and put themselves in a situation where they can win the game. So that's why I worry about this Kansas City Chiefs team at home with no playoff experience under your starting quarterback's belt.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.